Okay, so, yeah, I would like to thank the organizers. This is really a great conference. It's just been, every talk has just been first rate. Lots of time for breaks. So I'm going to talk about some joint work with John McCarthy and Nicholas Young. So the idea is, goes way back. You have some mapping, let's say, from one domain into another domain. And you have the additional fact that some point on the boundary, so if I merely mapped into this domain, some point on the boundary here, which I'll call tau all throughout my talk, gets mapped to some point omega on the boundary of the target domain. So maybe the range of phi looks like that. And so the circle of theorems due to Carathéodory, Julie, and Wolf all concern trying to prove various regularity results about such a function at the point tau, and showing that various different types of regularity are or are not equivalent. Okay, so I guess the first big advance was due to Julia in 1920, and all they really did was write down a condition that's mystified people ever since. Perhaps I should say all the theory is local. So there's no loss of generality in assuming that the domain is D and the range is D closure. So I'm going to assume phi maps D in the D closure. And I'll abbreviate that to just saying phi is a sure function, a bounded analytic function on the disk whose soup is less than or equal to 1. Okay, so Julia's condition said, suppose I have a function phi, and suppose I have a point tau, so phi is in the sure class, tau now I guess is a point on the circle. He said, okay, look at 1 minus phi of lambda n divided by 1 minus modulus lambda n. He said, assume there's a sequence lambda n that converges to tau non-tangentially with the property that that ratio is bounded. So I'm going to draw a box around that, and I'm going to refer to it in my talk as condition on. This is not a theorem, it's just a condition on a function. Okay, looking at it from 90 years later, merely writing down that condition is really 90% of what Julia did. And then all the theory, you know, okay, fine, you know, but this is just an unbelievable thing to write down that condition. So it has all kinds of implications. So the first one is, if I holds, then three things happen. One, there exists a unimodular constant, omega, with the property that as lambda tends to tau non-tangentially, phi of lambda tends to omega. So phi has a non-tangential boundary limit, and it's a unimodular number. So we can speak of the value of phi at tau whenever phi satisfies the Julia condition at tau. And I'll refer to this omega as phi of tau. And the second thing that happens is I'm going to have to refer to this thing so many times in this talk, I'm going to give it a name. I'm going to call it the Julia ratio. So this is the Julia ratio of phi at lambda n. Second condition says that if you merely have the Julia ratio is bounded on some sequence, then you immediately get that its limit exists. So the limit as lambda tends to tau of the Julia ratio is in fact equal to some number. We can call it alpha. So notice that these two facts say you can attach to any point satisfying condition I two numbers, an omega and an alpha. So that's sort of the logic of what's going on here. And then the third condition is the so-called Julia inequality. So that one says omega minus 5 of lambda absolute squared over 1 minus modulus 5 of lambda squared is less than or equal to alpha times tau minus lambda over 1 minus mod lambda squared. So this is one of the reasons Wolf was so interested.
There's a problem with this thing.
This is why Wolf got interested in the theory. This is, this has significance in complex dynamics. If you want to understand where this comes from, it just comes from these two things and a little bit of clever algebra. What you do is you take the invariant Schwartz lemma on the disk, and then you just attempt to take some limit of it and get a limiting inequality as you let one of the points tend to tau. And conditions 1 and 2 allow you to do that, and you get this inequality. So this is just the Schwartz lemma with one of the points moved to the boundary. Okay, so that's the easy part of the theory. Now, there's two other components to the theory. There's a second condition Julia considered. Two, I'll call it. Okay, two is, well, once you know that phi has a value at tau, you could look at the difference quotient of phi, where one of the points was tau. So you could look at phi of tau minus phi of lambda over tau minus lambda, and you could say, you could attempt to take the limit of that. I guess if the limit of that existed in some sense, that would be like saying phi is differentiable. Right? And in fact, that's the result. So this is going to equal some number, the derivative of phi. Now, I never should have started on this side. I can see it's torturing you. But I know you have an eidetic memory, right? So it's okay if I... let's see, what is this alpha? What is this alpha? Okay. Why don't we compute that alpha? Let's see, I computed it. Well, you compute alpha assuming phi is analytic. And it's a simple exercise, right? Alpha is the limit of the Julia quotient, so you can compute it just using the L'Hopital's rule and express it in terms of the derivative of phi, and then you get tau phi of tau bar alpha. Whoops, no. Phi prime of lambda. This tells us two things. We can solve for phi prime, and we get phi prime of lambda, and apparently is going to be tau bar phi of tau alpha. So we know what to put here. We want to put tau bar phi of tau alpha. Okay. And... Yeah, sorry. Wow. Who was that? Okay, very uplifting. I know that somebody isn't sleeping. It makes my talk so much more exciting and gratifying. The other thing it tells us is what this stupid number, I shouldn't have called it a stupid number, what this number alpha really is, this number alpha, well, it's this. Okay, anyone that's proved the argument principle, notice phi of tau is unimodular, so this is really phi prime of tau over phi of tau. So this is really just the rate of change of the argument of phi with respect to the argument of lambda. So in other words, alpha is just some positive scalar that measures how fast phi is spinning at this point tau. Okay? So Julia wrote this down and then thought he proved it. And it was 9 years before a correct proof came up, but people still argue about this. They still will argue about whether or not Julia really proved this theorem. So I'll call this the Julia-Garathiodori theorem. And I didn't tell you what the theorem was. This is just a condition. It says if I holds, then in fact II holds. In other words, the reason this said the modulus. When you say this, you're just saying the modulus of phi is differentiable at tau, or rather non-tangentially differentiable. And now we know the reason. It's because phi itself is non-tangentially differentiable. That's what this theorem says. 9 years later, Carathéodory said, hey, what if we look at the derivative of phi itself? Okay, that's certainly something that makes sense for all points lambda in the disk. Now we know that phi is also differentiable at tau. We could ask whether or not they hook up. And that's in fact what Carathéodory proved. The limit as lambda tends to tau non-tangentially at phi prime of lambda is the derivative of phi at tau, which we decided is trying to look like this magical number. So this is a third condition. And what Carathéodory proved was that if 2 is true, then 3 is true. Okay, this was in, 1929? I'll refer to this as Carathéodory's theorem. Okay, so that's a crash course in this business. So we want to generalize to the bidisk. We want to generalize all this to the bidisk. So how are we going to do that? Well, first we need to know what we mean by non-tangential. So this is a hornet's nest. If you look at the several complex variables literature, we're just going to take the most boneheaded definition you can think of. Suppose S is a subset of the bidisk. And we're going to say, and tau is a point in the torus. We'll say S approaches tau non-tangentially. The set S approaches tau non-tangentially. If two things happen. The first thing is we want to be able to actually approach tau through S. So tau is an S closure. And second off, we want to say no matter how you approach tau through S, you have to stay away from the boundary. You can't get arbitrarily closer to the boundary than you are to tau. So we can say, write that by saying there exists a constant C such that the distance, I'll write this, the distance from a point lambda to tau is bounded by a constant times the distance from lambda to, now here I want to take the boundary of the bidisk. So this is something no one ever works with. It's totally anti-intuitive, right? But that's the correct notion. The boundary of the bidisk. So this means take the topological boundary of the disk across the disk. So that's the torus together with all the faces. Okay, smallest c such that this is true is the aperture. And we call that the aperture of S. Yes, I left out my quantifier for all lambda and S. Okay. So what would Julia's condition become? Julia's condition would become I, this is our new I. Okay. We want to say there exists a sequence lambda n approaching tau non-tangentially. So that means the set of points in the sequence approaches tau non-tangentially in this sense. Okay. With the property that the Julia quotient is bounded on lambda n. Well, what's the Julia quotient? Well, the Julia quotient now at a point lambda n is going to be, let's see. Well, there's 1,000 ways you can do this. Don't ever read one of Abadi's papers because there's all kinds of technicalities. We're going to do the absolute most boneheaded thing. We're going to look at the numerator and say, well, phi maps the disk into the disk. The numerator is just the distance from phi of lambda n to the boundary of the disk. Well, that's the same, because phi is a scalar-valued function. The denominator, well, that's the distance from lambda n to the boundary of the disk. So that's what we're going to divide by, the distance from lambda n to the boundary of the bidisk. So that will be our Julia quotient. And this is bounded. Okay. And because we think we're so clever, it's going to be too hard to prove theorems about this. So I think the first thing we should do is make a definition, right? So the definition will be, if phi is a sure function and tau is in the torus, we'll say tau is a B point if this is true. So this is the notion. So the B points are just the points that satisfy Julia's condition. Okay. Now, to develop a theory of B-points, we're going to be totally shameless. Can you use those top blackboards?
Yeah.
How?
You lift this one all the way up to the top.
Excellent. Okay. So to develop a theory of these, we're going to be shameless, and we're just going to steal from Donald Sarrazin. Okay, so Donald Sarrazin wrote this book, Subhardy-Hilbert Spaces of the Unit Disk. Okay, and so what he did was he was shameless, and he stole from Pick, right? In one variable now, phi is a sure function, if and only if, the Pick kernel, is positive semi-definite. Okay. So what Sarrazin does in chapter one is he says, what does that mean? Okay, well, you used the theory of Debron spaces. Well, he used the theory of Debron spaces and sort of reworked this and was led to his sub-Hardy spaces, right? And then he went to town and he proved every single one of these theorems using the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality in Hilbert space. Okay, so that was what Donald did, and what we're going to do is we're going to pervert what he did, okay? So the way we pervert it is we take 1 minus phi of mu bar, phi of lambda, and we say, oh, this is saying that's equal to 1 minus mu bar lambda times some positive semi-definite kernel on the disk. Then we apply Ehrenschein to represent that kernel as u lambda comma u mu. And what would the logic be? The logic would be phi is in the Schur class if and only if there exists a Hilbert space M. This inner product is M. There exists a function U from the disk into M such that this formula right here holds for all lambda and mu in the disk. Okay? So that's the way we're going to pervert it. All perversions have their virtues. The virtue of this perversion is this theorem then will generalize to the bidisk. So we just simply have to juice this formula up rather harmlessly. Instead of getting a Hilbert space, so in the bidisk, this is two variables. So phi is any function on the bidisk. And then phi will be in the Schur class of the bidisk, if and only if there exists an M. Okay, now this M is a little more complicated than that M. It's not just a Hilbert space. It's a decomposed Hilbert space. It's a Hilbert space together with a decomposition. So I'll write it as M1 for X sum M2. I'm using superscripts, and they correspond to the fact that we have the points in the bidisk have two components. Okay, and there exists a function mapping now the bidisk into M such that, okay, now the formula here gets replaced by, for all lambda and mu in the bidisk, we have 1 minus phi of mu bar, phi of lambda. That's the same. Okay, and this is sort of the same. We still have u lambda inner product u mu, but we replace the scalar 1 minus mu bar lambda with a really simple operator. And we stick it right here, 1 minus mu star lambda. Now, what's this? Well, lambda is a point in the bidisk, but if lambda is a point in the bidisk, or actually a point in C2, you could define lambda as an operator on M in the following way. You just let lambda equal the diagonal operator acting on M, where this is the diagonal operator with respect to our decomposition. And that's the meaning of this. So we formalize this into a definition, which I won't write out. But we say that the pair, if this formula holds, then we say the pair, if we've got mu and this formula, we say the pair mu is a model for phi. And then the theorem is, if phi is a function in the bidisk, phi is in the Schur class if and only if phi has a model. Okay. So now what do we have? We have three notions that we've generalized to the bidisk. We have the Julia ratios. We've generalized the Julia ratio. We've introduced the concept of a model and we have the notion of non-tangential convergence. So here's two key lemmas that relate these objects. So phi is in the Schur class, tau is a point in the torus, lambda approaches tau non-tangentially, and mu is a model. Okay, so the first fact will, I'm sure, warm everybody's heart. The Julia ratio on the sequence lambda n is bounded. This is the Julia ratio is bounded if and only if u lambda n from the model is bounded. So we've turned boundedness of the Julia ratio into boundedness of some vectors in a Hilbert space. Okay. Two, if tau is a B-point, okay, so the idea of this lemma is the moment you see a sequence of vectors in a Hilbert space that's bounded, what do you start salivating? Ah, they'll be convergent, weakly convergent subsequences. Okay. If tau is a B-point, then u lambda n converges to a vector x in M weakly if and only if u lambda n converges to x in norm. So armed with these two lemmas, we can then prove the B-point theorem. So this is a theorem that tells you what B-points are in both operator theory terms and function theory terms. This is the B-point theorem. Phi is in the Schur class, and tau is a point in torus. The following are equivalent. One, tau is a B-point. Two, there exists a subset of the bidisk, and there exists a model M, U, for phi, with the property that S approaches tau non-tangentially, and U lambda is bounded on S. Three is, for every S in the bidisk, and for every model MU, if S approaches tau non-tangentially, then U lambda is bounded on S. Four, there exists a set S such that J that approaches tau non-tangentially, such that J is bounded on S. And five, for every S that approaches tau non-tangentially, J is bounded on S. So that allows us to pass back and forth between the function theory and the operator theory of these B points in a rather seamless way. So now we want to develop a theory of B points. This just gives us conditions. So we stare at this lemma. You can stare at this lemma for a long time and just never really quite believe it. And the proof doesn't really tell you what's going on. So what you have to do is be bold in a situation like that and make a definition. So what we're going to do is we're going to try to measure. I mean, if you stare at it, I didn't believe it. I mean, we worked for like a month thinking that we were just being stupid, and that in fact, I mean, the only way you can explain something like this, right, is if there's really just one limit point, right? But it turns out that's not true. Okay. So what we do is we introduce a set that measures the extent to which this is false. Okay. And that would be the set X tau. So we define X tau. So this would be if phi is in the Schur class and tau is a B point. We introduce X tau. That's the set of all X and M with the property. I firmly believe that the chalk in Canada is not as dense as the chalk in California. Maybe that's one of the reasons the University of California is bankrupt. Do we pay more for our chalk?
I'm sure we pay less.
Oh, okay. So we're going to look at the set of all limits that you can get as lambda n approaches tau non-tangentially. So we look at the set of all x and m with the property that there exists a sequence lambda n, such that lambda n approaches tau non-tangentially, and u lambda n converges to x. So x tau is a measure of how discontinuous of u is at this point, and how discontinuous the Julia quotients of phi are at this point. Okay. And we have a theorem. Here's the theorem. Okay. Turns out that all is not chaos when you study this set x tau. It turns out that there exists a unique vector, which we call u tau, in M, that is the closest vector in x tau to the origin. In other words, there's a unique vector of minimum norm. So there exists unique u tau in M with the property that the norm of u tau is less than or equal to the norm of x for all x in M. See, this is there's a unique u tau in M such that this is true, and the u tau is in x tau. There we go. Gosh, nitpickers. Okay. okay. So once you stare at that, you say, well, there's this distinguished vector in x tau, and then since it's too hard to prove theorems, you know, you want to immediately make another definition, right? And so this would be the next definition. I guess what you'd want to do is say tau is a C point if x tau is equal to this unique vector. In other words, there's only one vector in x tau, and it's this u tau. Okay. Now, that's exactly the condition, that's exactly the definition you want to make. That's exactly what you want to have. You want to have a C point if you want to make further progress in regularity. You want to show phi has greater regularity than we currently can show or the function theorists can show. This is just exactly the definition you want to make. But now the problem is, if we go off now and we prove all kinds of deep theorems about this model, and the function theorists are just, their eyes will glaze over and they won't care. So we need something to sort of, we need some sort of hook to get them interested in this definition of a C point. Okay, so here's how we would do that. Let's see. I don't know. Wasn't there supposed to be another blackboard? Did somebody steal it? Oh, there it is. Okay, so I'm not going to do the key calculation in the whole theory. This is what everything flows from. Okay, we pick a sure function, and we assume tau is a B point. And we pick an x in this x tau. And so now what does that x buy us, function theoretically? Okay, well, what does it mean to be an x tau? Well, it means there's a sequence mu n converging non-tangentially to tau with the property that u mu n converges to x in the Hilbert space. That's exactly what it means. So now I don't know where's our realization formula? Look at this formula. We let mu equal mu n. So since mu n is tending to tau non-tangentially, phi of mu n tends to phi of tau. Mu star tends to tau star. And u mu n tends to x. So what we end up getting is a semi-model. 1 minus phi of tau bar, phi of lambda, equals 1 minus tau star lambda, u lambda, comma, x. So we end up getting that formula. Well, we can solve that formula for phi of lambda. Let's do that. So remember, phi of tau is unimodular. So we get phi of tau, we multiply by phi of tau, bam, and then solve for phi of lambda. Let's see, phi of tau plus phi of tau, the scalar phi of tau, 1 minute, tau star lambda. Whoops, please flip, right? Tau star lambda minus 1, u lambda comma x. So I just solve for phi of lambda. Now, we're going to do something psychological. We're going to factor tau star out. And we have lambda minus tau. Ooh. U lambda comma x. And now we want to compare u lambda to x. So that means I'm going to add and subtract the term. So I end up getting phi of tau plus, okay, what is this? This will be lambda minus tau, and we'll have phi of tau, tau star, x, comma x. And then we're going to have an error term, which will look like lambda minus tau, phi of tau, tau star, and now we have u lambda minus x here, times x. Okay. So what do we see from that formula? We see that if we pick any set F in the bidisk, okay, and it has the property that the limit as lambda tends to tau through S of u lambda is x, and we know there's at least one such set because x, little x, is an x tau. But if we pick any set S, the property that u lambda tends to x, and many of you might have seen something called a projective k limit. So this is sort of like, this is the comic book version of a projective K limit. Okay, in any case, we just simply say we've got a set S with the property that u lambda tends to x. That's sort of the most general notion of a projective K limit. Then what will happen? Well, that says the norm of u lambda minus x is going to 0. That's the same as saying this is going to 0. Okay, now we look at this term. This is lambda minus t. So that means this whole term right here is little o of the norm of lambda minus tau. So what this formula is exactly saying is that phi of lambda has a first order approximation. This term is linear, right, in lambda minus tau. So this formula is exactly saying phi of lambda has a first order approximation at tau. So let's formalize that as a definition. Definition. If phi is the mapping on the bidisk, and tau is a point in the torus, and S is a subset of the torus of the bidisk with tau and S closure, we'll say phi has a holomorphic differential at tau on S if we have a first order approximation of this type. In other words, there exists three scalars. I'll call them omega, eta 1, eta 2, such that phi of lambda, for lambda in S, phi of lambda looks like omega plus eta 1, lambda 1 minus tau 1, plus eta 2, lambda 2 minus tau 2, plus little o of the norm of lambda minus tau. Okay? So this is slightly different than the normal definition of a differential because it's holomorphic. It's a holomorphic differential. That's because we just have two terms here rather than four terms. We've just taken the two holomorphic terms. And it's on S. In other words, this approximation doesn't work on a neighborhood of tau. It just works on the set S. So what have we just shown? We've just shown that if we pick an x tau, and we have any set with the property that as you approach Tau through the set, U lambda approaches X, then on that set, phi must have a holomorphic differential. So it's like a way of talking about phi being smooth, but on a general set. And it could well be, you know, you have two different sets, and on each one it's smooth, but the two differentials don't hook up. They aren't the same. But on each one, if you just take the bird's eye view, you get smoothness. So this is exactly what you have to do in two variables if you want to study the singularity of a B point. What was a C point? The definition of a C point. That was the case where X tau degenerated to a single point. Well, if X tau degenerates to a single point, there's not much choice in X. There's only one X. And so no matter how you approach X. Right? So what this allows us then to give a function theoretic characterization of C points. Right? And so that's the C point theorem. I'll state it right here, right next to the B point theorem. So this is the C point theorem. Okay, so phi is a sure function, tau is in the torus. The following are equivalent. One, tau is a C point. Remember the definition of that was the set X tau degenerated to a singleton. Two, okay, it looks exactly the same. You probably can all fill it in. Maybe I shouldn't bother to fill it in. Let's see. There exists a set S contained in the bidisk, and there exists a model. The reason there's all this gobbledygook here is it's very important that your notions be model independent. If they're not model independent, there's no chance that the notions that you define using operator theory will ever correspond to function theory. Okay, so that's why all this logical gobbledygook is in here. S approaches tau non-tangentially, and U lambda extends continuously to S closure. In other words, U lambda is continuous all the way up to tau. Okay, two, for every S, if S approaches tau non-tangentially, U lambda extends continuously to S closure. There exists an S in the bidisk with the property that S approaches tau non-tangentially, and phi has a holomorphic differential on S. By the way, this is with the omega having modulus 1. You have to require omega has modulus 1. And finally, for every S in the bidisk, if S approaches tau non-tangentially, and then phi has a holomorphic differential. Now, this is not quite right. There's a technical modification I need to make. This S right here and that S right there, in addition to approaching tau non-tangentially, have to be untapered. Untapered? So what does untapered mean? Untapered means they don't degenerate and aren't thin. In other words, you don't want the cone as it comes in. You don't want S as it comes in to be coming in so that its sides are tangent to one another. You want some sort of actual fat set of directions you can head coming out of tau into the bidisk that are in your set. So that's the definition of untapered. So that is the C point theorem. So once you, I guess that answers our question. So it seems like a function theorist should care about the case where x tau degenerates to a point. Notice that what this all boils down to, if you stare at this condition right here, S admits a holomorphic differential, a non-tangential holomorphic differential. That is exactly the conclusion of the Carathéodory-Julia theorem in one variable. So this is the best you can do if you want to prove a Carathéodory-Julia theorem in one variable. That's it. It's the C-point theorem. Well, now there's also the Julia theorem, and well, I mean the Carathéodory theorem. That's the fact that 2 implies 3. Well, I guess we've decided that condition 1 is being a B-point, and condition 2 is being a C-point. Okay, so apparently being a C-point implies that the non-tangential limit of the gradient ought to equal the gradient on the boundary. So that would be the Carathéodory theorem. So how would that go? I guess we had to sort of have to figure out whether or not we believe there's a gradient on the boundary. See, here's our holomorphic differential. Oh, man, I can't believe it. I just erased the formula for the holomorphic differential in the case of a C-point. It was right here. You remember? What did we have? We had lambda minus tau, phi of tau, tau star, x comma x. That was our linear term, and then, you know, we had phi of tau, and then we had our little o. So that was phi of lambda. So we can read off the gradient of phi at tau from this in the case where you have a C point. When you have a C point, there's only one x in x tau, and that's u tau. So this is u tau, the unique vector in x tau of minimum norm. And you just write this out. Remember, these are just diagonal. And remember, the elements of M decompose. So this decomposes as x1, x2. This is diagonal tau 1 bar, tau 2 bar. So you just compute this. You have two terms. You have lambda 1 minus tau 1 times some number. What's the number? It's phi of tau, tau 1 bar times the norm of u tau 1 squared. Okay. Plus phi of tau 2 bar times the norm of u tau 2 squared times lambda 2 minus tau 2. So it would appear that the gradient of phi at tau when you have a C point is given by the formula phi of tau, tau 1 bar, norm u tau 1 squared, and phi of tau, tau 2 bar, norm u tau 2 squared. If we compare that with our formula in one variable, we see that there are two angular derivatives, right? There's two of these. There's two rates of change of the argument of phi at the point. The alpha then gets replaced by the norm of u tau 1 squared and the norm of u tau 2 squared. Okay? And this is the formula for the gradient of phi of tau. And then Carathéodory's theorem would read something like the following. And if phi is in the Schur class and tau is a C point, then the limit as lambda heads to tau non-tangentially of the gradient of phi of lambda is equal to the gradient of phi at tau. And that is exactly the way Carathéodory stated his theorem, what, 80 years ago. I'm done, so. Out of modesty, I wanted to, but I, you know, My co- I'm hoping, you see, I'm hoping my co-authors in the front, you know, they know I'm never, not going to look at the preprint after a certain point, right? I was hoping they would relabel them, you know, the Agler point of type 1 and the Agler point of type 2, but I don't think that will happen, and so.
But can this number alpha, the limit of this junior ratio, but then there was some arbitrary Hilbert space you introduced in the Aronjohn segment, and if you look at this formula for the gradient, you know, in a higher dimension, I'm sure there's an analog in one dimension. So if you get some, this number of the limit, is it independent of the norm and of the Hilbert space? You always get the same number? Something obvious?
I don't want to say it's obvious, but it's not deep.
So it just happens that your choices cancel themselves out.
That's right. That's right. You end up. This is, by the way, one of there's two ways you can work. Everything I told you works in the model. So in other words, you have a model. That's this Hilbert space M together with this function and this formula. Now, once you have that model, you can then proceed to make a realization of the model. So this is what engineers do. You get an A, B, C, D. Right? Then you can do calculations using the realization. Now, many of these ideas become extremely weird when you pick the realization, because the realization is not unique. So in one realization, one thing happens, but in another realization, it won't. And it's kind of hard to tell what's going on. So this is the virtue of trying to work in the model as long as you can. Now, having said that, when you prove this theorem, you use realization theory and use operator estimates and whatnot. So I didn't answer your question.
You didn't say why it's related to the
idea. Yeah.
Aren't the quantities you end up with over here, they only depend upon the function. There's no Hilbert space in most of your calculations, are there?
No, but there's a norm of the Hilbert space there.
Yeah, no, but I mean, in his expressions, in other words, he's got these five equivalents of these
elements.
Most of...
Yeah, these properties, so he's asking a different question. See, these properties won't depend upon what M you pick, right? That's because of the logic of the way this is stated. But he's wondering, well, why, this is a number though, see? This is a number. Why, if I picked a different M, should this number be the same?
Okay. But isn't M uniquely determined? That's what I thought. Isomorphism? Unitary?
No.
No, it just represents positive.
Well, no.
No, but your expression.
In one variable, M is uniquely determined.
Oh, okay.
And that's why, so in other words, in one variable, there's a formula for the kernel in terms of the function, right? In two variables, there's not. See, so there's lots of models. There are many models. And so you want to, if you want to do function theory, then what you try to do, you want to use Hilbert space methods, because they're so, you know, you can do them even if you're dumb, because, you know, your arsenal consists of, I've got the triangle inequality, and I've got Cauchy-Schwarz. And fortunately, in this situation, armed with those tools, that's all you need, right? So you want to work with the Hilbert space methods, right? So then that means if you want to do function theory, and you're in two variables like this, you have to confront the fact that the model is not uniquely determined by the function. So you seek to make definitions that are model independent. You seek to make Hilbert space definitions, but you need them to be independent of the model you chose. And then that, anytime you can do that, you've actually discovered a function theory property.
Well, if there are no more questions, it looks like we start again in 6 minutes. What are you doing?
stuff like this that they have.
That's the smallest laptop I've ever seen.
I know. Is that a full laptop, or is that one of those net things?
So you can do internet?
Yeah, anything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 2 years ago, it cost more than $2,000. Now, it costs more than, not more than $300. But mine's expensive.
Yeah.
It's $500.
The keyboard's a little small, though.
But I have a pen. I can use a pen to write.
Okay.
That extra advantage. I can take notes.
So it knows your handwriting. It's learned your handwriting.
I mean, yeah, I can...
Oh, thank you.
I have one other question that I wanted to, because I didn't think it was necessarily relevant to the thing, but you can phrase the condition in terms of the completeness of the bourbon and the well. Something can be phrased in terms of completeness. So you're looking at a limit as you go to the boundary of the dish.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, I mean, you're saying there's a comparability when you pull back the Bergman metric, but
mm-hmm.
not,
right?
And so weren't you tempted to use that particular metric for the buy disc rather than look at...
Uh-huh. Well, that's sort of the classical approach, to use the Bergman metric
right.
to try to... That's like what Kranz has done
result.
That, right?
Okay.
But see, they don't get any definitive results that way, see, because the Bergman metric is not... canonical, I can say that freely because Hormunder's not here. Right.
Still buying. Everything.
Pardon?
Still getting the room.